Welcome to the Sounds of Success, brought to you by the National Association of Professional Martial Artists. This audio magazine is a tool for generating profitable ideas and for taking your business to new levels of excellence and performance. Here you'll find real-life case studies of school owners just like you who have applied our proven successful business and marketing principles to their school and are creating the business of their dreams as a result.
Today, NAPMA members, we have on the phone Miko Pellet, who is the U.S. representative of his traditional Goju-Ryu organization, which is the, I always get the letters messed up, but it's IOGKF, so it's the International Okinawan Goju-Ryu Karate-Do Federation. And
right.
He's also is that right?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. The only thing, we've restructured the organization a little bit, so I'm no longer like the head chief instructor or anything. But I'm a part of the organization or anything. But we're doing some restructuring, so I'm not sure of that anymore. But
just
to be accurate, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. That makes sense. And basically, a couple of the reasons that we wanted to have Miko on the call today was obviously in the martial arts industry there are many little sub niches. There are schools in the industry who are primarily focused on, let's say, for example, after-school transporter karate. There are schools in the industry who are focused on, you know, adults-only schools. There are some schools that are sport-oriented schools, some that are competition, you know, that type of thing. And Miko has a very interesting blend in his school where Miko is a very traditional Goju-Ryu stylist. So we thought he would be a great person to bring to the table and to have all of our NAPMA members be able to plug in and kind of hear a little bit about how Miko's school operates and some of the gains and growth that he's experienced in the last few years. And I've got to tell you, Miko is one of the members of Stephen Oliver's coaching program, and he's been one of the very fast implementers. He's been one of the guys that has been able to get some fantastic results in a very short period of time by implementing some very strategic marketing systems and some very strategic sales and business systems inside of his school. And what we wanted to talk about a little bit today, Miko, is sort of how you found the blend between being a very traditional stylist and still having a very successful business. So I think that'll be very valuable for the members. So anyway, welcome, Miko. Thank you so much for making it on the call today.
Sure, thank you. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, I'm glad we could finally get connected. But anyway,
yeah.
Miko, tell me a little bit about your background. I know that you and I have known each other for a while, but I know that you came from Israel and had studied martial arts in England and a few other places. Well, why don't you give everybody just a little bit of a thumbnail sketch of where you came from and where you are?
Sure. Well, like you said, I came from Israel. I was born and raised in Jerusalem. I started my martial arts training there, and, you know, people take martial arts very seriously there. At the time, there were two dojos. There was a Shotokan dojo, and then there was us. We did the Okinawan Goju-Ryu stuff. And both dojos had, a lot of students. And so they're both doing, you know, really well as far as numbers. So I trained there. I did that a couple of years through high school. I had to do my military service, so I did that for 3 years, mandatory. And then when I got out, I just wanted to pursue karate as a career. And so I knew an instructor that used to come and visit us from England, who had a dojo in London. And so I traveled there, trained with him for a couple of years, and I got my black belt there. And then after I got my black belt, which was a few years after that, in other words, a few years of training in London, I really felt that there's got to be more to martial arts than, you know, just training a couple times a week, 2-3 times a week. And he recommended that I go to Japan and train there. So I went to Japan, trained there, lived in Tokyo for a couple of years. And that was, you know, that was an incredible experience, training 2-3 times a day, 4 or 5 days a week. You know, so it really gave me an idea of what traditional martial arts are about, what Goju-Ryu karate is about, and gave me a sense that there's a lot of depth, which is really what I was hoping to find. And I did that for a couple of years. Then I was training there with Master Higaona, who's the chief instructor for Okinawan Goju-Ryu and for the IGKF. And he relocated to the U.S. for a few years, and I decided to just tag along with him. I wanted to keep training. And this is exactly 20 years ago. In fact, we just celebrated our 20th, my wife and I just celebrated our 20th year here in the United States. It was exactly 20 years ago we came. I worked with him for a while at his school, then I opened my own school. So it's 18th, our school just celebrated its 18th anniversary. And started in a small place, just a couple of students. Then, I put an ad, finally managed to scrape up some money, put an ad in the family magazine. It was like $400 or $500, which was a ton of money at the time for me. And then I started getting a lot of kids. And I was in San Diego at the time, and right now I'm in Coronado, which is, it's adjacent, of course, to San Diego. It's connected by a bridge. It's a beautiful old town. And I started getting students from Coronado, and I went from, 10, 15 to 50. And I thought, wow, it was unreal. And then I started going out to Coronado and actually teaching there once or twice a week. And so I had another 30 or 40 students that were just there. And after a couple of years, I got smart and I just opened the school in Coronado, closed the school in San Diego because 80% of the students were coming from Coronado anyway. And then I was at a small facility for a while, and then I moved to the facility that I'm at now in 1995, I believe. I moved into the facility where I am right now. And at the time, it was, I just started, like I always have and always will. I love karate. I love Goju-Ryu. And so I taught, from my heart, and I sold from my heart. So I really didn't know anything about business strategies or about marketing or whatever. And so it was more luck than brains and maybe some innate, talent that I might have had that I didn't know about. I tried all kinds of business systems and all kinds of using all kinds of consulting services that are out there. And at one point I heard Stephen Oliver speaking at a conference, and I could tell, you could tell the guy knows what he's talking about. He's really smart. This is 13 years ago.
Right. Probably the EFC convention.
Yeah, and then after that it was touch and go. We would do pretty well, and then it would be kind of a lull, and I'd do pretty well, and, because the initial move to Coronado, I signed up, I don't know how many. I went from maybe 80 to, to 200 literally overnight. And I wish I'd known then what I know now, because I probably would have had a lot of those students, a lot more would have stayed than had, quite a few did stay. And that's it. And it's been really good, but there's ups and downs, and some years are better than others. And I always thought that you had to, as a traditional martial artist, you had to either practice traditional martial arts or you could get another job and make money. And I never thought that the two could ever meet, that you could combine the two. I knew that you could, use some smart business practices and do well, but I never thought you could, you could really sustain any kind of a lifestyle that's more than, up to, I thought there was a ceiling, I guess is what I'm saying.
Sure.
And then a few years ago, when was it? It was probably 3-4 years ago at the Super Show in Las Vegas. I saw that Stephen Oliver was having a one-day event, which is only him, and so I signed up for that. It cost more than the whole Super Show.
Right.
I had a feeling it was going to be a good thing, and it was a very good thing. And he introduced the coaching program. And of course, the first thing you think about, oh my God, can I afford this? This is so expensive. And it seemed like a lot of money. But like I said, I always had a really good feeling about him as a person, and also the stuff that he knows and the stuff that he shares and the stuff that you pay for with him. And it was really good, and I joined the coaching program. It took me a while to digest it, but I think within a week or so, I was on. And it's been 3, maybe 4 years by now. I haven't looked back. I mean, the difference in working with a coaching program was twofold, or the advantage. One was financial, knowing how to charge, how to put together a program, how to put together financing, how to put together monthly payments versus paid in full, how to have the brass balls, for no use of a better term, to really charge what I thought I should charge and what I thought I should be getting, given the experience and given the program that I had. And the other aspect of it was really putting together a program that has the quality that justifies the kind of tuition fee that we charge, that I wanted to charge. So it's not just like you work, okay, on how to con people to pay you a lot of money and then just give them, you know, bad karate or not really have a program in place, but how to put together a really good program in place, a good belt system in place, things that make sense, so that everything is congruent with everything else. So what you're charging and what you're giving, you know, people can justify paying for that. And then, of course, learning how to market it, and how to, which is really another way of saying, how do you explain to people what the quality of the program? In other words, being able to put it in words that the parents can relate to, or that people can relate to, how to write an ad that explains it, how to sit with a parent and explain it, and how to teach your staff to sit there and explain it as well. So all these things came with working with Stephen Oliver with the coaching, and it came in at a level that I never thought was possible. Sure. I never thought, like I said, I always thought there was a ceiling. I never realized that you could go way beyond that ceiling. And I'm learning as we go along more and more that ceiling is, once you break that ceiling, then it's all in your mind. You know, there really is no ceiling. So you can really offer better quality stuff. You can really improve. You can really rethink your program, rethink your curriculum, rethink your service as a learning institution, as a school, and also rethink the financial benefits of running a good school as a business.
Absolutely. Very well said. Let me stop you for just a second and back up and cover a couple things that I think were extremely valuable that we really want everybody to take away today, if nothing else. But number one was let's get a little bit of a perspective about your school, first of all, and then we can kind of hit a couple of these bullet points. What your school is in Coronado, California, which is a little island off the coast, and about how many square feet are you teaching in right now?
I've got 2,300 square feet.
Okay.
Probably, excuse me, probably about half of that. Well, maybe a little bit less than half is the floor, and of course there's the office, the corridor, the changing rooms, and a private lesson room.
Sure, sure. Okay. And your current student count is about what right now?
It's about 230.
230. Okay, good. And okay, so the reason I wanted to ask those two questions are, you're not one of these super schools that's, 13,000 square foot, 10,000 square foot, 7,000 square foot standalone facility. You're an average shopping center size martial arts school, which
right.
Frankly, in the Mile High Karate model and in many other models, is what our trend has been in the industry lately, has been to scale the size of the schools down and make them more serviceable, so that the rent and the overhead is more manageable and things like that. But anyway, just to be illustrative, 230 students in 2,300 square feet is a very good blend, right? It's not overly crowded. It's not empty.
Yeah.
So it's a very good number. Let's kind of back up for everybody and touch base on a couple of those things that you mentioned. Number one is you're very, very, very focused on quality. And of the Goju-Ryu Karate associations and the Goju-Ryu Karate systems, they're very traditionalist and very rooted in their style, which is not a bad thing. In fact, one of the things that we talk about in almost all of our coaching sessions and all of our group meetings is culture. And culture is extremely important in a martial arts school, not necessarily that, what the master says is exactly what happens. That's very important, not necessarily because it's right or wrong, but because that's what he said, if that makes any sense. So let me clarify that. It's maybe not so important that a person learns to chamber their punch on their belt knot. On their hip by their belt or by their ribs. It's not necessarily so important to argue which one's right. It's only important that you've picked one. And it's 100%
exactly.
Consistent between all the students and all the instructors and the entire culture
that's
of the
right.
school.
That's right.
So that's exactly right. So that's putting culture above even what that component of the style is. So
right.
You've done a masterful job at combining a very traditional curriculum with business concepts that actually make a successful business happen. Tell me about your internal thinking. How did you come to understanding that the kick and the punch is the tool, but the system around the student is really the vehicle that gets the outcome that you're looking for. What was your evolutionary process on that?
Well, the word revolutionary is really the word. That's a good choice of a word. I think first of all, realizing that, like you said, it's like what you said, it doesn't matter where the hand is in the chamber as long as it's consistent, and this is the style that we follow and we understand why we do it. And also we need to understand that just because somebody else may do it differently doesn't make them bad or stupid. You know, there's a lot of the really good martial arts out there, and they hold their hands in different places on a chamber, and they're all good people, and they're all smart, and we can learn from each other. I think that's one revolutionary step that still a lot of traditional karate people that I know, martial arts people, have a problem with. It's like, it's my way or and everybody else is trash. And I think one of the things that I went through is realizing, hey, you know what? These guys do it differently, and they're really, really smart, and they just do it differently. But they're really smart. They got a lot to offer, and they do good things. And I think when you realize that, that opens your mind to the lots of other possibilities. Typically, in the traditional, you know, martial arts world, the karate world, the business aspect of the people, the karate schools that are businesses that are more commercial, always looked at as, you know, giving up quality or you know, compromising quality. And I used to think that way myself until I started going to seminars and I met some really, really smart people who make a lot of money teaching karate that's different than what I teach, but is good. It's just as good. And maybe a lot of times it's even better. There's no point in trying to judge who's good, who's better. We do what we like, and as long as we're true to ourselves and we do a good job teaching it, then that's all that matters. And so that was a big step for me, realizing there's a lot of smart people out there that I can learn from who may be doing things differently, but still I can learn from them and perhaps they can learn from me. And then the other thing is realizing that money is not a bad word.
Sure.
Marketing is not a bad word. I remember the first time a mother said to me that I sell karate really well, I was in shock. I thought, how could she say such a thing? I don't even know how to sell. This is a long time ago, and I just convinced her that, you know, the best thing for her son is to continue, not to quit. You know, it's the most basic thing that we as karate instructors can say to a parent. The best thing for your kid to do is not to quit, even though maybe he's not that motivated right now as he was 6 months ago when he started. And I convinced her, and she thought that I sold it really, really well. And what I realized is that selling something that you believe in, selling something that you care for, so selling something you're excited about, is, number one, not that hard, and number two, the more tools you have, the better. And it's a good thing to do. So again, coming from that traditionalist, kind of attitude where money is bad and making money is bad and commercializing is bad, that was a very revolutionary move for me to realize that it's actually a good thing, because the more people that get the message, the more people that I can serve, the more people are going to benefit from karate, from the martial arts, from the program, from the great instructors that I have, from having good role models, from having something in life to which they can relate and to which they can hold on. When, you know, even in life of kids, there are several areas that are very times that are difficult. Going to first grade is a big thing, you know. Going into third grade is a huge thing. Going into middle school and high school, I mean, this is huge stuff for little kids. And the thing, what I always tell parents is that karate is so good because it keeps our feet on the ground. It's steady, it's stable, it's ongoing, it's always there. They can rely on it. And then when they get into these difficult times in their lives, they have this anchor that really keeps them together. And I've seen it happen over and over again through the years. So to be able to articulate that and then to put that in a relevant way in an ad, for example, to put it in a relevant way when you're trying to sell a black belt course, to put it in a relevant way when you're enrolling a student to just begin, you know, their journey in karate, if you don't have those tools, you're not going to do it. You're not doing anybody any service. If you don't know how to market this, you could be really excited, but if you don't know how to do it properly, you're only going to be so good. Whereas if you have the tools, then you can be fantastic, you know. You can be really good. You can impact a lot of people. And then realizing that, you know, teaching karate is not about just yelling at a bunch of kids and making them do what you want them to do when you want them to do it, but working with them, realizing what their strengths are, encouraging them when it's time to encourage them, correcting them when it's time to correct them, but doing it in a way that's positive, because building self-esteem is the most important thing that we do, and nobody can do it quite as good as we do because nobody's got the tools that we have with the belt and with the different programs and stuff like that. I mean, it's almost like karate was, or the martial arts were specifically designed for building self-esteem in children. With the belt and with the goal setting and all and the stripes and everything. I mean, these are incredible tools, and if we know how to use them, we've got somebody helping us put it all together, then we can really see, you know, breathtaking results with kids. And, of course, the parents see the results, and then we have a better reputation because people talk about us. And I see it, you know, I get an email from teachers and from parents all the time that go back to the fact that how karate and how the martial arts have such an incredible impact on kids and on people. And if we limit our ability to sell it, if we limit our ability to market it, then we're limiting those people's ability to improve, if that makes sense.
No, I think that's absolutely right. I think the word that you said that kind of sums all that up is service. In some people's minds, there's a disconnect between service aspects of what we can do and actually persuading someone that they should do it. And they feel like, well, if I have to talk someone into it, then it's not right for them. When really in human nature, it's our nature to be, for lack of a better word, lazy. It's our nature to not want to move. Miko, you and I are both big fans of Dan Kennedy, and Dan Kennedy talks about, when you're talking about marketing, he says you have to picture your prospect sort of like Homer Simpson, sitting at home on the couch with a beer in one hand and the remote control in the other hand. And you know how he kind of slides down to the couch, right? Well, you have to kind of picture your prospect that way, not to be disrespectful to our prospects, but this is it's a very illustrative example. And if you picture Homer clicking through the channels, and at some point he takes a drink of his beer and drops the remote control. Well, it has to be a pretty bad show on TV for him to muster up the intestinal fortitude to reach down and move enough to pick the remote control back up, right? So you have to sort of think about in a marketing situation or in a selling situation that your prospects have inertia. And if they're sitting on the couch with the beer in one hand and the remote in the other, it takes Herculean effort to get them to move, to get them to do anything, you know? And that's what I think some people perceive that to be, you know, quote, selling, when it's really just trying to get that person motivated and get them to move and get them to do what everybody knows is best for them, what they know is best for them. But,
right,
you know, they need a catalyst. They need somebody to help them and walk them by the hand through the process. And I think the word that you use, service, is exactly right. If you have 10 students in your school and you love those students and you make a big impact on those 10 students' lives, that's great. You've made a big impact on 10 people's lives. But could you have 200 and impact them just as deeply? Absolutely, you know. So then I think it's our duty to make sure that you can have 200 students or 300 or 400 students and impact those people too. So I think that was exactly right. And you know, something you said in there, Miko, too, if you could expand on this. It seems unfortunate that it's in many cases the very traditionalist martial artist that sort of thinks this way or has this mindset maybe thrust upon them, but the mastermind effect is extremely effective. And, you know, every business from, let's say, organization from the Boy Scouts to Weight Watchers all use sort of a mastermind concept where Weight Watchers is a great example. You know, a few of the people that we know do a lot of marketing activity with Weight Watchers and some operational activity with them. And the Weight Watchers' entire business model or let's say success model, first of all, they're the most successful weight loss concept ever invented. And the reason they're so successful is because they take a group of, you know, 50 people who all have a similar goal, and they make them sit in a room once a week or once every 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And they hold them responsible for their results. They make them stand up and say, you know, hi, my name's Johnny, and I lost a pound and a quarter last week, right? And everybody claps their hands, and when they lose 5 pounds, they get a star. And I'm not exaggerating that. That's exactly how the system works. So that type of a psychological anchoring to be able to be open enough to surround yourself with people who do things differently than you do, but who are very smart and can be very successful as well, and you can extract those things from those people, I think is very evolved. you know, in your case. Can you talk about that a little bit? How valuable do you think it has been for you to be able to surround yourself with other very successful school owners, other people who are different than you are, you know, who have the same goals?
Oh, it's been terrific. Like I said, I used to think that if the people didn't do it a certain way, which was the way that I thought should be done, then they didn't know what they're talking about. And the reality is very different. And I think a lot of people tend to think that way, and it's a shame. I think an interesting, you know, we all like to think that what we have is the best, and that's fine. And you know, we all take pride in what we do, and the whatever martial arts system that we grew up on, and we like to think that it's better than others. And it's probably just because we like it and it fits us best, and that's fine. But like I said, being open to the possibility that somebody else might have a really good idea that we haven't thought of is really, really important. And the only way to do that is to get out there and meet people and listen to them. And some of them you're going to like, some of them you're not. But the point is that you open yourself up to possibilities, to ideas. And if you think that your thing is, or if I feel that my style is the best, that's fine. You know, then what I need to do is I just need to make sure that I know how to pass that message along. I think one of the best analogies that I've heard from Stephen Oliver is the Harvard, is the Ivy School analogy. You know, if you look at how they market, if you look at how they sell, and if you look at what they offer, number one, everything is congruent. The marketing is outstanding. They charge a ton of money, and they provide, you know, the best service there is in their field. And that's, you know, and so some of us are, you know, we like to think that we're the absolute best, and only very few people can, you know, can ever achieve mastery. Well, fine, but look at Harvard. You know, I mean, that is the epitome of quality. It's synonymous with high class. It's synonymous with top quality, with things that are hard to achieve but are worth working for. And I think it's relevant in the martial arts because this is exactly what we're about. We're about taking people. They never knew they could be things they never knew they could achieve. And then, but again, we have to have a good, really good program, and we've got to be able to charge and justify what we charge. And so what always goes back to opening up, listening to other people, having an open mind, talking to other people, interacting, having the benefit of somebody who's smarter than we are, telling us, giving us advice and giving us suggestions and seeing what they do and how they do it. And I can't overemphasize how important that is in preserving any, you know, all the martial arts. I mean, martial arts are a valuable asset to society. I think everybody realizes that. Even people that don't know anything about karate or any realize that they're a valuable asset to society today. And if we want to maintain that, if we want to keep it alive, then we've got to work together. We've got to open our minds to each other and listen to what we all have to say, and kind of be the kind of people that we want to, that we pretend to be, that we say we are, which are open-minded, independent thinkers, open to suggestions and so forth, and that we're not afraid to learn, not afraid to learn from others who may be doing things differently. I can't overemphasize that, and even if our style is the best, it doesn't mean that we teach it the best. It doesn't mean that we know how to market it the best. It doesn't mean that we know how to put together a program that will motivate people to see it. And you know, the Simpson analogy is a good one. Another analogy is people are suspicious. Sometimes maybe they've had a bad experience with another karate school. Now the other guy might have been a creep, and you might be the best guy in the world. But if that's the experience they had, they're not likely to come in and sign up at your school because they think all martial arts are the same. Maybe they're suspicious and they don't want to pay money, and that's their issue, you know. And so once they know the value of what you have to offer, money is no longer an objection. It's no longer a problem. But you've got to know how to work through these things. And if we don't have the tools to work through these things, these people are not going to sign up. They're not going to come to our schools. So however
Absolutely.
It is, you know, so however it is that we see ourselves, it's important to open ourselves up to and learn from you know, what other people have done, and realize that we're not the only smart people. There are a lot of smart people out there.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, let me put some numbers on something that you just said. First of all, I think what you said is exactly right and very valuable. You have to continually surround yourself with people who are as good or better than you are at what it is you want to do. And in our case, in my case specifically, and in Master Oliver's case, and in many of the other people in the NATMO organization now, of course, we've had to develop new skill sets. We've had to develop, you know, new marketing skill sets and new video and audio and all of these other skill sets. So we've sought out some of the best people in those industries to come in and to help us learn those things. And I think that's a valuable asset for everybody to be able to be in that mindset. But also, you said a couple things that I think are extremely important for everybody to kind of focus on. Number one, the biggest difference between success and failure in a martial arts school is the ability to clearly articulate and communicate the benefits that the students should achieve. And bar none other, you could have someone in the school that is a fantastic martial artist, an unbelievable teacher, and a great instructor. But if that person or that school can't persuade mom and dad that this is something that Johnny should do, then it doesn't matter. And right now, the industry stat, Nico, I'm not sure if we'd ever talked about this or not, but it's impossible to accurately measure. But with all of the data that NATMA collects and all of the data that we've compiled from billing companies and from list brokers and other people in the U.S., the nearest we can calculate is that the martial arts has about an 8% market penetration, which means of all the people in the world, of all the people in the U.S., that fit our demographic profile. Right now, mostly children from 13 and under is about 70% of the martial arts population in the U.S., of the people that are currently studying. So if you extend that statistic out and make that predictive, then we're only touching about 8% of the people that could possibly benefit from our services. Which means if you're in an area of 100,000 population, then only 8% of those people are currently participating or have participated in martial arts of one form or another, which obviously leaves a huge pool. 92% of the people haven't experienced our thing. They haven't experienced what martial arts can do for them. So obviously there's a huge disconnect in the industry as a whole. To be able to penetrate that market deeper, we have to be very good at communicating what the benefits are. So I think that's an interesting statistic that everybody should kind of take to heart. You're only actually penetrating 8% of your market, so certainly we can do better at that. The second thing that you said is there's also a direct proportion between the student outcomes and the amount of, let's say, financial tuition that a person can logically charge in a school. And, of course, you being a very traditional martial artist, everything's not about dollars and cents. It's about great quality students. And as long as you can generate great quality students, you can command a higher price point, just like your Harvard analogy. But let me clarify that a little bit. If there's anyone on the call or anyone that listens to the recording that has a problem with charging a high price point for their tuition, you need to really look at your market closely. Most people think that their market just simply won't pay that much. And in the Mile High Karate model, our initial price point is around $197 a month. So a brand new enrollment is usually paying just under $200 for their tuition. And some schools are just flabbergasted by that. They don't understand how that can happen, and they think that their demographic is different, or they think that their business is different, or they think that their location is different. And in some cases, those factors do factor in, but usually not as much as the owner thinks they do. But I had a very interesting experience 3 days ago, and there's a brand new Huntington Learning Center that's opening about a block and a half from one of the schools that I operate. And the Huntington Learning Center, I had a great lunch meeting with the franchisee and with their operations director. And frankly, if you take the Huntington Learning Center UFOC, their franchise document, if you take theirs and if you take the business plan of a karate school and tore the covers off of each one, you really probably couldn't tell the difference between the two. I mean, the business model is so similar. Their marketing materials are very similar to ours. Their business processes are almost identical. They have a two-intro process just like we do. They call it a an evaluation exam or a skills assessment, and then they do a discovery of findings with the parents in the second intro. So it's exactly the same way that many martial arts schools operate. But anyway, just to sort of expand everyone's thinking on what the market can bear as far as price point goes, if you have a high quality product, if you have a high quality school with high quality student outcomes, the Huntington down the street, the average package that they sell is a 250-hour package. A student normally does 2 hours a day, 3 days a week, which is 6 hours a week. The tuition is between $47 and $65 per hour. So that would be, let's say it's 50, let's say it's a round number of $50 an hour. That means it's roughly $300 a week for a Huntington tutor. Now, you know, I got to tell you, Huntington's a very successful franchise. They have lots of locations all over the U.S. and especially in the Southeast, and there's no price resistance to their product, and the reason there is that the parent very clearly identifies that they believe that this system of learning will help Johnny learn better. It'll help him increase his reading level, two levels, whatever the case may be, and they don't have a problem with investing in their children's education. So if you have a Huntington anywhere in your city, or a Sylvan Learning Center, or a Kuban, or a competitive gymnastics school, or a competitive dance school, then probably there's a lot of elasticity in the price point. If you're charging anything under $150 a month, you probably have a lot of room to go before you really run into any market resistance on that. Now, all of that is predicated on what you said, Biko. As long as you believe in your service and you over-deliver on every promise. Our model in Maha Karate has always been to deliver $4 in service for every dollar in tuition that we charge. So you know, we have all sorts of bonuses and extra things that the students get on an unexpected basis and stuff like that. But like you said, as long as it's based on sound martial arts outcomes, you know, good physical outcomes for the students, but great character outcomes for the students, I think that the price is very elastic. Tell us a little bit about what your structure looks like in your school. Where did you start at when you first started teaching out there, and where are you at now?
Well, let me just say one thing that goes directly in line of what you just said.
Sure.
And then maybe taking the comparison between us and those learning centers one step further. This has just happened to me like 2 days ago, so it's fresh in my mind, but this family who's not particularly well off, not particularly wealthy at all by any means, they had a little boy who has been coming to karate, but he's also been having some trouble in school. Mm-hmm. So mom obviously went to check out the, I don't know if it was Huntington or which one, but one of those learning centers, and you're right, it was $200-$300 a month. And there's no way that they were able to afford that. I'm sorry, yes. And there was no way for them to be able to afford that and karate. And the teacher recommended karate.
Right.
In other words, when the mom came to the teacher and said, well, here's my problem, you know, I've got an active young boy, you know, first grader, whatever, and he's all right. He's obviously really active, hard for him to sit still in class. Plus, he's got some, maybe he's got a learning difficulty, maybe not. It's too early to tell. So the teacher said karate over the learning center, and I've been in touch with that teacher since, obviously, working with this kid, and I think the teacher got it, that there's something here that in karate he's going to learn how to become a better student, he's going to become, you know, self-starter, he's going to learn how to, you know, channel his energies, he's going to learn respect and all these other things on top of learning how to be a better student. So that was just to kind of, you know, follow up on that comparison, because I think it's a great comparison.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely.
You know, like I told you, I thought there was a ceiling, and I thought the ceiling, you know, I remember once hearing somebody, this is maybe 10 years ago, or maybe even more, saying that there was somebody that they knew, that they heard, that charged $100 a month for karate.
Right.
And wow, can you imagine that? And I thought the ceiling was that probably $100-$120 a month. I mean, that was the ceiling, you know. And I remember distinctly talking to Stephen Oliver once, because I used to have my black belt program was $3,300 paid in full, $3,600 if they make payments.
Hmm.
And there were payments of $300 a month.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, if you can get them to, if they're paying $300 a month, they can pay $300 a month. You know, why are you only charging them for 12 months?
Right.
Why not
charge
the $300 a month for 30, you know, for 36 months or the length of the program? And I was flabbergasted. I was just floored. I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe the simplicity of it and how much it made sense. And of course, it took, you know, it was tough for me. It was hard the first couple of times to actually charge, to ask that, because I wasn't confident enough. You know, I'd never done it before. And sure enough, he was right. I mean, that is exactly, that's exactly the way to think. It's all a reflection of how we value our product. It's all a reflection of how much we think we're worth and how much we're willing to ask. And then, like you said, if we have a good program and we're giving back $4 of service for every dollar of that we charge, which I think is a great, I think it's a great way of thinking. It's a great way of working. The bare fact that I'm going to steal this and put this in my office, that was a great line.
You're more than welcome.
But I think this is exactly the way to think. This is exactly the way to do it. And if you do it that way, then charging $300 a month is not that outrageous. And so I started off by, charging somewhere along the lines of, you know, between $80 and $120 a month, and thinking that I was, you know, charging a lot of money. And then, like I said, working with Stephen Oliver, you know, getting his input and his perspective on how this works and how to compare the service with what you charge, with the tuition, or I should say how to pair the tuition with the service, and how to increase both, increase the value and increase the tuition. Right now I've got the basic program, which is $169 a month. And I've got what I call the Black Belt program, which is $269 a month. And then I've got a leadership program, which adds another $150 to the $269, so whatever that adds up to. $400.
About $410, yeah.
And those are the three programs that I have, and of course they've got to qualify for Black Belt course. And then they've got to super qualify to get into leadership. An interesting revelation was when I started getting, you know, obviously there's some objections and some people aren't going to pay that. And I really freaked out at first. I mean, again, what working with Stephen Oliver helped me see is that it's the percentage of rejection of the people that aren't going to do it is pretty much the same percentage of the people that said no to paying the lower prices.
That's right.
And
yeah,
so
I was just needing a little bit more. Yeah,
you know, I was just a little more uptight, but that didn't make any difference. And you know, some people are not going to pay, and maybe I didn't do as good of a job as I could have in showing them the value. And I always look back and see, well, did they really get the value? Because what I'm learning by experience, and I've heard this a lot, but of course I'm experiencing it now, is that it's hardly ever the price. Rarely is the issue the price. The issue is always that we didn't really get the value across, either to the students or to the parents, or sometimes both.
That's right. You know that's instructive. There's kind of a tangent, and I want to come back to another point here before we run out of time. But a real quick tangent on this is, you know, we've always told the story, and we do it every year. We tell the story about the time machine. You know, if I could put you in a time machine and take you all the way back to the day before you decided to join karate and take away all the knowledge and experience and focus, confidence, self-esteem that you've gained since that day and give you back every dollar in tuition, would you take it? You know, and obviously, you know, nobody would take that deal. And then we try to push them to the next level and we say, okay, well, what if I gave you, you know, $20,000? Would you take that? And of course, nobody raises their hand. And what about $50,000? What about $100,000? What about $1 million? Would you take $1 million to trade what you've experienced and what you've learned in the martial arts? Would you take it? Would you trade it? And of course, nobody ever takes us up on the deal. So our only challenge is to get the mom and dad of a white belt to see through the eyes of the mom and dad of a black belt. You know, very
right.
Simple. And in that case, the price is very elastic. But again, you know, just to make sure that everybody understands crystal clear what we're talking about, this all has more to do with the quality of the service than it does of anything else. So it doesn't have anything to do with your demographic or your market or your location or anything like that. It has everything to do with what the outcomes of for your students are. And if you've got one superstar black belt in your school and everybody else, you know, sucks, then it doesn't do any good. But if you've got 50 or 60 really, really good black belts who are very, very respectful and who, when the parents of the white belts see those black belts in the school, they want Johnny to look just like them. That's what we're talking about. That's high-quality student outcomes for the long-term benefit of a school. And that's really what we want for our schools anyway. That's really what we want for our students. So that's fantastic. So last point, Miko, real quick before we – I think we're going to get cut off in a few minutes here. But tell me a little bit about what's next for you. I know that most martial arts school operators, they go through a curve, and towards the top of the curve is – once I have my school systemized and I'm operating mostly with staff members, and in fact, I think this is instructive for all of the people that will be on the call, is you've gone from, in just a few years, you've gone from chief cook and bottle washer with your finger involved in every aspect of the business on a minute-by-minute, second-by-second basis, all the way to now having the freedom and the ability to go to Israel for like 2 months, right? Something like that. How long were you gone? 6 weeks?
You're right, yeah, 6 weeks, right.
Yeah, like 6 weeks. And pretty much when you got back, the school was, like, still there, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Everything was there.
Yeah, you know. So tell us a little bit about that, and then tell us a little bit about I know that you're one of the charter members of our wealth group, which is basically taking our martial arts focused businesses to the next level, and expanding our thinking on what's possible, not just in a single school, but in an organization, and as a congruent unit between us all. What's next for you, and how were you able to accomplish doing what you did, being able to now have the freedom to go to Israel for 6 weeks and have everything, you know, still operating and functioning at a high level when you got back?
Yeah, like I said earlier, it's all a question of realizing that there's no ceiling. And so at every step of the way, every time I view a ceiling now, or I begin to think that there might be one, I'm looking for ways to break that ceiling into, you know, and I know it's a figment of my imagination. There is no ceiling. So when this wealth group idea came up, I thought, okay, there's probably something out there that I don't know, and I want to know about, because my imagination is beginning to think that there's a ceiling here. So, I took the plunge, and I'm glad that I did. It was great, because again, it's all about for me anyway, realizing that there is another step, even though I may not know what that step is right now. You know, I may have a really good business plan, but it's limited by my own perception. So working with somebody who's smarter than I am and who's got more experience than I am and who's been there and done that, and is ahead of me is exactly what I needed. And so the wealth group is terrific. And again, to be in a small group with like-minded people and to have somebody who's able to lead me to, you know, again, break those barriers and move forward is fantastic. So that's what it's been about, you know, going from, like you said, the cook, the dishwasher, and everything all in one, into being able to delegate and trust my instructors to do the right thing even if I'm not there, and to delegate and trust my office people to do the right thing even if I'm not there, and to realize that there's fax and there's an email, that there's an emergency, and that with everything that's at stake, it's still not, you know, it's not the Department of Defense or the CIA headquarters where we're talking about a World War III situation, that if I'm not there, someone's going to press the red button. It's not that bad. And when you come back, things are still going to be there, the good students with the bad, the good parents with the annoying parents, and the good things and the problems. And so being away is, you know, I like to travel, and I like to take a family to travel, and so that's our big thing. Restructuring my own personal goals, restructuring my goals as a martial artist, restructuring my goals as a business person, and realizing that there's a lot more possibilities out there within who I am, which is a, you know, somewhat of an entrepreneur, somewhat of a of a business owner, somewhat of a martial art, or not somewhat, but you know, all these things put together, and a martial artist, and that really the sky's the limit for me, and therefore the sky's the limit for my students. And everything that I gain as a result of doing this kind of work, I can pass on into my students and say, hey, guess what? You know, I'm at this point in my life, I'm realizing still that the sky's the limit. So, you know, you guys, it's true for you too, and you can really shoot for the stars. So, you know, that's kind of where it's at for me right now.
Absolutely.
So I'm excited about all these, discovering all these possibilities, it's just a great experience.
Absolutely. You know, that's a wonderful lesson too, that, you know, we all say it, we all teach it, but very few of us live it, right?
There's
so many instructors that, you know, are fantastic instructors. They'll walk out on the floor and teach an inspiring class to a group of 9-year-olds and show those 9-year-olds that there's nothing that they can't do if they put their mind to it and they put their sweat and their energy into it. And then as soon as they walk out the back door, they're surrounded by the cloud of indecision, where they're not where they want to be at in their career, they're not where they want to be at financially, they're not where they want to be at emotionally, they're not where they want to be at with their relationships, but yet they just taught a class of 9-year-olds that there isn't anything that they can't do. But all of a sudden, I have all these self-limiting beliefs. That was one of the reasons, and you've been through a lot of this stuff, but you know, that was one of the reasons that we brought Lee Miltier's program into the coaching program and into the wealth group and into the Peak Performers and Inner Circle and Maximum Impact groups, because more than anything, it's changing the way you think. It's changing the way you think so that your day-to-day actions will be better and will be more focused on your goals than just, you know, going through the motions. And two things that you said I think that are really important is, number one, expanding your thinking about what's possible. And I think if there's anybody on the call, if there's anybody that listens to the recording that thinks that it's impossible to run $1 million a year school, they're wrong. We've got three members in our inner circle group, all of which that operate $1 million a year single location schools. And each one of the three, it's an interesting trend, they all have fantastic student quality. None of them are out there peddling garbage. They have awesome student quality. Otherwise, they'd never be able to get to that level. You know,
that makes perfect sense, really, when you think about it. Sure.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. And the second thing is, I think that you've done a masterful job at this. It is, you made up your mind, and I think Master Oliver was telling me it was like a couple years ago. You made up your mind that the business serves you. You don't necessarily serve the business. And what that means is you're there to be the owner, you're there to be the entrepreneur and the driving force and the manager behind the staff's activities and all that stuff. But ultimately, it's your business, therefore it has to facilitate your life goals, not necessarily that you have to physically be there pushing the buttons every day. And I think that's an unbelievable balance. You have a tremendous balance between a very traditional martial arts background, a very traditional martial arts school, a great business operation that's helping you to do what you want to do. And that's I think that's something if the listeners to the call can take that home and think about how they can structure their business so that they can accomplish some of their personal goals internally and external to the school. I think that's a huge lesson.
Toby, there's the human weapon series that came out that A&E did a while ago.
Yep, absolutely.
My instructor, Master Higaona, is on that in the karate section, and he's the last one in the karate chapter, yeah. They went to Okinawa, they interviewed him, and they walk into his dojo, and they really realize that he's a true master of karate, and it's, you know, it was very, very cool to see that. You know, I've been to his dojo in Okinawa many times and so forth. But it's interesting because at the very end, these guys, you know, they go out and they have this fight. Mm-hmm. The guys that run the show, the two narrators.
Mm-hmm.
And they train with all these different masters. They train with him, and he's the last one. And after that, they go to the fight. And he looks at them, and he goes, in this broken English, he goes, I cannot. He says, no, I can. You always have to think, I can. Moving forward, always think, I can. And so, you know, we made a big deal of this at our school, that we made sweatshirts and say, I can, and we, you know, we made the kids, you know, decide what it is that they're going to be, that's going to be an I can thing. But it's such a powerful message, and it's within all of our martial arts. You know, we tell, like you say, we tell our students, we teach our students, you know, don't think I cannot, go from I cannot to I can. It's a very simple message, but, you know, it's really important for us as instructors to do that as well, you know, to go from I cannot to I can.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. And you're a fantastic example of, it doesn't matter what style we're talking about, if it's a traditional style, if it's a sports style, if it's a striking style, if it's a grappling style, it doesn't matter what our pedagogy or what our lineage is. All of those things can add up to what we focus on. It can add up to what we want it to be. And I think you've done a masterful job at that. Miko, thank you so much for your time today. I think it was an outstanding call. I'm really excited to get this out to all the members and especially those guys who have very traditional schools to show them what's possible. And trust me, if you're listening to the call, I mean, Miko's students are fantastically skilled. It's not no one in his organization and no one that we really work with on a one-on-one basis is out there peddling garbage. They're all out there teaching good quality, strong martial arts with great student outcomes. And Miko's found a tremendous balance of making a successful business out of that, but also having that business fulfill his personal goals. So I think that's great. Thank you so much, Miko.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. I'll speak to you soon.